Hello, and welcome to The Runs, the podcast in which we discuss runs of comic books. This week's show, we'll be discussing the Allens, Moore and Davis, their run in 2000 AD of DR in Quinch. My guest this week is Douglas Wolk. I'm going to introduce you first, then we'll talk about the comic book. I'll do your introduction. You can tell me what I got wrong. Cool. Douglas Wolk is a comics historian and also a music historian and writer. He's written about music and comics for this whole century, for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Nation, etc., etc. Recently wrote all of the Marvels, which to me has been a ubiquitous book. I kept hearing about that book, but to me, you will always be the guy who wrote the 33rd and a third book about James Brown live at the Apollo. I'll tell you a little history. My first ever regular job, creative job, was at the Willamette Week, which is like a local alt weekly. We're both Portland guys. We'll get more into that in a second. And I did comics journalism for the music section. And the editor, the music editor, he just handed me that book. He was like, "You got to read this." And it was one of those things where I went home and I read the whole thing. I'd seen James Brown live a couple times, you know. And I love that book, man. I don't have a copy, actually. I should ask you if I could score one off you. I'm going to pay for it. Oh, great. Okay, cool. But I remember, like, I read it in one sitting, you know, and I ended up reading a bunch of those books, and they really vary. Like, some are, like yours was, where it's really very smart investigation of what you're hearing and context and things like that. And some of them are like a tone poem by a writer, sort of like describing how they feel when they listen to music, which I don't want to read at all. So
there's some amazing ones. The one that John Darnielle wrote about Black Sabbath's Master of Reality is a novel. It is his first published novel, and it's amazing.
Okay.
And there's one that Franklin Bruno did about Elvis Costello's armed forces that is an alphabetical sort of encyclopedia of the racial politics of that album.
Oh, wow.
And also
that's cool.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it really, I mean, so I read a handful, and then it depends on how much you like the album too. Like the Bizarre Ride to the Far Side one, I really loved too. That was a really nice breakdown. And I know so much more about that album from reading that book, you know? So, but I digress. Did I leave anything out? Is there anything else you want to be? Oh, and we both are teachers in the PSU Comic Studies program.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I do like sort of context between me and we don't know each other at all.
Right? Not especially, no.
I think I met you in person at least once some time ago.
Definitely.
But yeah. Like you're a familiar face and we've both, you know, been in Portland a long time and sort of related work, but I don't know if we've ever had a conversation before.
Yeah. No. We're just sort of in the same circles. We know a lot of the same people, but this is first real, like getting to know Ryan. It's great.
It's our first chat. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you have any context for who I am or anything, but I'm the guy who does this podcast is all you need to know. And so, yeah, you being kind of a historian of comics makes you, I think, a particularly interesting guest to have on. So usually I'll go, okay, here's DR and Quinch. Here's the sort of Wikipedia-esque description of what it is for context, but I think I will ask you to do that if you are open to doing it. So I always invite guests to pick the run, and this was your suggestion, and I thought it was a great one. So lay it on me. What is this?
So it's a weird one. Okay. So DR and Quinch is a serial that ran in the British Weekly Comic Book 2000 AD between 1983 and 1985, on and off. 2000 AD has been running since 1977. It is still coming out weekly. It is up to issue like 2300 and something at this point.
Okay.
It is best known for Judge Dredd, who has been in almost every issue, not all of them, but it's an anthology. There's usually like five or six different stories in each issue, and a lot of recurring characters, and they're all like five or six page stories. So they're really, really compact. And pretty much any British writer or artist you have ever heard of who has done stuff in American comics cut their teeth in 2000 AD. And some of them still do stuff for 2000 AD now. So DR and Quinch was Alan Moore and Alan Davis collaborating for the third time. They had already been doing Marvel Man, Miracle Man together. They had already done some Captain Britain stuff together. And as I understand, and I may be getting this part wrong, Alan Davis thought that he had been, you know, getting pigeonholed as a like serious action comics person and wanted to let his funny side out. Mm. Now, one of the recurring features in 2000 AD was a thing which was originally Tharg's Future Shocks, Tharg being the alien from Beetlejuice, who is the editor of 2000 AD. Mm. Whoever the actual human editor of 2000 AD is at any given time is always just referred to as Tharg.
Oh, okay.
Even by people who write and draw for 2000 AD. Like, oh, I got a call from Tharg asking if I could do a cover. Tharg's Future Shocks was like a series of like 4 to 6 page like twist ending stories, science fiction stories. And there was a spinoff of that, which was Tharg's Time Twisters, which was like 4 to 6 page stories involving time travel. And Alan Moore and Alan Davis collaborated on one of these in 1983, which was the first DR and Quinch story. Mm-hmm. It is a straight up ripoff of OC and Stiggs. This was a thing that had appeared in a bunch of issues of National Lampoon.
Okay.
About a pair of juvenile delinquent dirtbags wreaking havoc. And so this first D.R. and Quinch story is D.R. and Quinch have fun on Earth, and the premise is basically, what if O.C. and Stiggs, but aliens and time traveling?
Mm-hmm.
And it was apparently such a hit that it got spun off into a regular feature that started 7 or 8 months later.
Oh, so there's a gap between the first. So yeah. When it appears in 2000 AD, the first one we read, is that a reprint of a Future Shocks, or is
no,
that?
No, that's Future Shocks is a feature in 2000 AD.
Got it.
It appeared in an issue of 2000 AD, yeah.
Right, because it's May 83 and then January 84. So there's a gap there. And then, yeah, was that a well-known thing, the National Lampoon? I don't know. National Lampoon is one of my blind spots, like, because I got a sense, like, from the name being so specific, and then I, you know, read the Wikipedia or whatever, and it described, but it was like, it's a parody of something I'd never heard of.
So. Yeah, I think O.C. and Stiggs was a movie, but also, like, I didn't know about this until, you know, 15 years after I read these stories. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay. And so the basic premise is there, and the narrator's very specific voice is pretty similar. Mm-hmm. The piling on of adverbs, basically.
Yeah, and the that they're all kind of heavy narration, or even like epistolary, like a letter being written.
Right.
And then I like things too that are like a parody that has outlived the source material.
Yeah.
Like the movie Airplane is like a send up of these like airport Zero disaster Hour. Movies. Yeah.
It was one specific movie called Zero Hour. It is a line for line version of that. But yeah.
I've heard that. Yeah. But also just in general, there was like a period in the 70s of these like airport and nobody remembers them, but everyone knows airport. There's like, I love that as like a weird niche thing. And then so further out, like what is your relationship with these comics?
So I read these comics when they were coming out. I was 13, 14 years old. Okay. When I was 12 years old, my parents spent 6 months in Switzerland. Okay. We traveled around Europe a little bit. We went to England, and I beelined for Forbidden Planet, which was the big comic store in London. And I had seen a few issues of 2000 AD before this, and I was really, really curious about them. And I bought, you know, 15 issues worth of 2000 AD that was coming out then, which was prime stuff. And little 13-year-old me obsessed over these. And when I got back, I went to my local comic store and was like, this is a British import. If you get it for me, I'll buy it. Mm-hmm. And so every month or so, I would get like a stack of 4 new issues of 2000 AD.
Cool.
And so I was like reading it as it was coming out. And it was, it was delightful.
Where were you then? What store?
That was Curious Bookshop, where actually by 1984 I was working there. Because I was like the kid who came in every Friday. And after I'd been doing that for long enough, they were like, okay, Douglas, we're just going to teach you to use a register. And so I was working there. And
I was that kid too. My first job was at the local comic store. I was about 14. Yeah. I just hung out there so much that they finally where was that?
East Lansing, Michigan.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. So you're getting imports of the, and so you're reading them as they were coming out.
So I'm reading them as they're coming out, yeah.
That's cool. I had never heard of these. I'm a big Alan Moore guy. I've read a ton of Alan Moore, but I had literally never heard of this before. And I was just like, man, you invite Douglas Wolk on your show, you get a deep cut. You know, I was so happy to see these. And it was fun to read. I mean, it's definitely, it's early, early Alan Moore, right?
Yeah. Totally.
Like almost day one. Is this like some of his first stuff?
No,
or you said this was after Marvel Man.
So it's after Marvel Man. It's after you've been doing Captain Britain. It's after like Maxwell the Magic Cat and The Star is My Degradation and kind of that early stuff. And he'd kind of cut his teeth writing a bunch of these Future Shocks and Time Twisters, like between 2 and 6 pages long. And there's a bunch of those. And then I think his first regular serial there was a thing called Skiz, where he was pretty much assigned to rip off E.T. at a point when nobody knew exactly what E.T. was. And, like, you know, it's an alien and he befriends a kid and that's what you've got to go on. So he did that. And I think then D'Aaron Quinch, and then after that was The Ballad of Halo Jones.
Yeah, I haven't read. So 2000 AD also is just a total blind spot to me. Like, I've never read a Judge Dredd comic, and I didn't even know. I was like, oh, it's in black and white. Like, that's how little I know. I know it as a thing, like you said, of every British writer, you know, Grant Morrison and all these guys, Kevin O'Neill, like everyone's done stuff in 2000 AD. But this is actually the first time I've read 2000 AD. So this was a really cool. There's like a lot of European comics in particular I've just never gotten to. So this was really cool to get to finally read. And then what is your hot take on Alan Moore?
Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, he can be difficult, but who cares? He's great. Yeah. He's so good. And some of his more recent stuff has a very, like, look how clever I am side to it, but he really is that clever is the thing.
Yeah.
And this, you know, when he is trying to be funny, he can be really, really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And this still makes me giggle like decades on.
Oh yeah. We'll talk about you read these kind of at the right time too, right? Like you're totally because when I was a teenager, I mean, I'm a big Alan Moore guy, and I would even say I'm an Alan Moore apologist, you know. I mean, I never met him, but I really don't like the sort of fan pushback on Alan Moore, you know, that it's like, maybe this is why he's so crabby, you know, or that, like, we shouldn't touch Watchmen, you know. It's like this thing, it shouldn't be a movie, or there shouldn't be sequel. It's like, just let it be this great work and leave it. I just think it's gross, kind of. But also, you know, I haven't had to deal with him. You read sometimes, like, other creators' kind of interactions with Alan Moore sound. But he sounds to me, and it's not surprising to me, like somebody arguably the best writer ever in comics, definitely in genre comics, I would say, pretty inarguably. And then, like, the functions of the industry kind of, like, pushed him away, you know? Yeah. Like, we kind of ruined it for ourselves. And then I feel like these internet pushback about Alan Moore sort of self-evident of that.
Yeah, there's an amazing thing that Leah Moore, his daughter, wrote a few years ago about the pushback that he was getting, saying, like, look, nobody loves genre comics more than my father did. Mm-hmm. Like, and he had such a terrible time with the industry that, like, he burned out his joy in these things. I had to, like, take his old comics to keep him from throwing them away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is not him just turning crabby in his old age. This is like, no, they ruined it for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. I mean, because he really has done, you know, I mean, everyone's read Watchmen, but he's done enough, you know, From Hell. And then, so when I was a teenager, the ABC line came out.
Yeah.
And that was one, when I worked at the comic store, you know, that was one of the great periods of my comic fandom. You know, top 10 is to me like my favorite one of those.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I want to do that on this show sometime, top 10, because it's only 12 issues and then a really good kind of prequel book. But that was just a very fun time. And that was sort of like the last kind of mainstream comic stand of Alan Moore, you know?
I just got his supposedly final comic, The Moon and Serpent Bumper Book of Magic, which just came out a couple, like, I think a month or so ago. And it's the thing he's been working on for like 20 years. It is, it is his grimoire. It is his history of and guide to magic. And it looks really huge and really dense. And I'm going to have to like find some time when I can just sit and not be interrupted and read it.
Yeah. Sound. Yeah. Good luck.
Yeah.
I hope your life is calmer than my own.
Yeah.
I hope so. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's my, oh, and then the other thing about that, the ABC line, is that this to me also is like, content wise, is sort of the kind of stuff you would later, much later find in like Tomorrow Stories.
Yeah, totally. Like the comedy he was writing. And there's always been like that side to his stuff. Like, I don't know if you've ever gotten to read the Bo Jeffries saga. That was a thing that he serialized in Warrior. And it is him doing, you know, the Addams Family, basically. Or the Munsters, you know, like household full of monster types. And it is full on comedy and really, really, really funny.
Okay. So, and you are of the, I believe actually when I read the Wikipedia page on this, which was deep research I did, I believe you were mentioned as like saying this is the funniest comic ever or something on that page.
No, I think it was like, I saw the Wikipedia. I was like, oh God, I hate seeing myself being quoted in when I'm trying to find information on something.
Why do you hate that? That should make you feel important.
No, it makes me feel like, no, there should be some other source I can get this from than the thing I wrote 10 years ago.
I mean,
yeah.
We all are uncomfortable with our own, you know, but I was like, whoa, it's Douglas Wogan. He's going to be on the show.
Yeah. But yeah, it is really funny. And it is well remembered enough that, so there's a character in Judge Dredd called Chopper, whose real name is Marlon Shakespeare. And a solid 30 years after these stories came out, there was a story involving Chopper, like fleeing while somebody, like the cover picture is like Chopper fleeing while somebody's firing guns at him. And the cover caption is "Mind the Ordnance, Marlon."
Oh, which like is the Marlon. Yeah.
The payoff to the big joke in here being "Mind the Oranges, Marlon."
Right. Okay. So, yeah.
And that like 30 years later, you're making a joke about a throwaway line in like this comic from 1984. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. Alan Moore. Are these, well, cause D.R. and Quinch, I would say, I mean, how would you say it's more remembered in the UK? Like, cause I don't feel like it's very remembered here.
No, it's not. I mean, it barely got published here. If at all, I think, yeah, people like 2000 AD fans love D.R. and Quinch. There was a little bit of an attempt to revive it a couple of years later, because Moore and Davis fell out pretty much after they finished D.R. and Quinch.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie Delano did a bunch of one page, like D.R. and Quinch's incredibly excruciating agony page things that were, and they didn't work. They just do not, like, if you don't have those two particular creators going full throttle on it, it doesn't work. And I have this whole thing about how, so beyond the stories that you read, there is one more D.R. and Quinch story that they did together, which was a 6-page story they did in like a summer special or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't work.
Oh.
Like it just falls flat. And I have this whole thing about how like the 5 or 6 other stories we have pretty much go through all of the possible comedy situations that you can get something funny out of with those characters. Because you've got, this is a little preview of what we'll be discussing. The first one, like the D.R. and Quinch Have Fun on Earth, like that is, these characters are agents of chaos. Then once it becomes a series, gosh, what's that first one called? D.R. and Quinch Go Straight. That is, here's what happens when somebody tries to suppress their chaos. It gets worse. The one after that is Go Girl Crazy, which is, here's what happens when they try to suppress their own chaos. That doesn't work. The one after that is the one where they get drafted, and that's, here's what happens when you put them into a violent situation and they get out of it through chaos. And then there's the Hollywood one, which is, here's what happens when you put them in a gigantically chaotic situation and they get out of it through superior chaos. And that's it. That's the possibilities for like the funny stories that you can do with them without kind of repeating yourself.
You feel like it ran its course.
Yeah. Like I would not want to see more stories. I think the ones we've got are great and I'm happy with them.
All right. Yeah, that's funny that there's one more that, because it's clear, like Alan Moore is one of those people that if someone else kind of takes on, you know, anything by Alan Moore, I never want to read anything by someone after Alan Moore left, you know, and Alan Moore characters are just like, that's it. There's no more, you know, I mean, Swamp Thing is endure, you know, there's been some characters, but
John Constantine. Yeah.
That's, I mean, he created that character. He never wrote the series though, right?
Nope.
Yeah. That's its own kind of, you know, maybe the exception that proves it or something. But I mean, there's been, you know, good Swamp Thing comics since too. But, you know, like, yeah, I'm never going to read a Tom Strong comic by anyone else or any number of things. So there's that element. But also that's interesting. You're saying that this, I mean, it's not a, this is kind of a gag strip really too. Like it's not really something that's begging to, something to go deeper on or, you know, quit while you're ahead. Yeah. So you want to just get into it? We'll do the first story and we'll move through.
Absolutely.
All right. So May 83, the first, and Alan Moore is credited in the first one as E.E. Quinch, who's the one of the characters, which I thought was odd.
Yeah. Ernest Errol Quinch. Yeah. You know, if there was a, if there was a story about Tharg in 2000 AD, because he occasionally appeared as a character besides being the editor, it would be credited as being written by, you know, TMO or the Mighty One, Tharg the Mighty. So, but yeah, this is, it's credited to E.E. Quinch, and he introduces himself in the first panel, and it is this absolutely wonderful Alan Davis drawing of this psychotic looking alien creature with tusks that go up all the way over his eyes. Like that is some design work.
Yeah, I love the Quinch design. Both the characters' designs, really, because DR's kind of got like a little bit of a greaser hairdo or something
that extends like half a foot in front of his face and kind of bends over it. Like perfectly funny. And this is you should describe the story.
Oh well, you know, well, and real quick too, is Alan Davis anyone at this point? Like he's sort of a, you know, comics royalty at this point, but this is pretty early for him too, right?
Yeah, it is. Like he and Moore have been kind of working together most of the time for 3-4 years now, something like that, max.
Okay. And he got his start working with Alan Moore?
No, I mean, I think he started doing some other things, but the first thing he did that really made any kind of splash was Miracle Man, Marvel Man. Mm-hmm. Which was running in Warrior. And then for Marvel UK, he had been drawing the Captain Britain feature for a little while, and then Moore came in and started writing it. And their Captain Britain stuff is super neat. And mostly, it's been out of print most of the time. It finally got reprinted again in Omnibus last year.
Oh, okay.
But it's... You can see echoes of it happening in, like, Excalibur comics, like, straight up to now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, or, like, Earth 616 came out of that run, right? The,
you know, name of it. It may have apparently got named 616 by Dave Thorpe, who was the person who was writing it before Moore. But that only appeared in the script. It didn't appear in the text. Like, it's real fuzzy where that name came from.
Okay. But Alan Moore is one of those guys, you know, that will kind of step in and write two issues of something. And then 30 years later, there'll be a Marvel event based on an unapproved treatment Alan Moore wrote in the 70s.
Or exactly. Like, you know. Yeah.
But yeah, because Alan Davis, this is definitely some nice stuff, but it's not full throttle Alan. You can see it's early Alan Davis. Like he's not quite where he's going to get to be.
Yeah. Alan Davis had actually a couple years before this done is he'd drawn a strip for 2000 AD called Harry 20 on the High Rock, which was like prison breakout in outer space, basically. And he developed his style real fast. You can see he's not quite where he got to, but he's real close to it.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, he's one of the great. He's great. So yeah. this is good stuff. But you know, like it's you can keep seeing where he gets to later, and you know he's not at his peak yet, I would say. Yeah. Which is kind of cool to see. So the first story, really threw me. That's great. It's basically these two young aliens are screwing around. Well, they get kicked out of school, right?
Right.
And then they're screwing around and they basically influence all of, not even human history, but the whole process of planet Earth. Like every kind of major historical event that you may be aware of planet Earth was directly influenced by these guys.
Including the beginning of life on Earth.
Yeah, and like the shifting of the continents and all the things. They just go through, you know, and then it gets more specific, you know, with the early people and the pyramids. But even before that, they go to, like primordial periods, and they're killing dinosaurs. And what do they got? Oh, gravity. Basically, so it's this long con. Yeah, all the UFO sightings in the 50s were them, and then it comes together so well, because I was like, oh, this is kind of clever, you know, they're influencing human evolution, but then they teach humans space travel, and so then they go to the, you know, collective alien gathering, whatever you call it. They're basically, Earth is getting initiated into the, like, intergalactic you know, Republic or whatever you'd call it. And then, so then Earth is shown on the screen, both sides. And then it turns out that the shape of our continents are, what are they? I can find the exact thing.
Shape of the continents in the Northern Hemisphere now spelled out. Dean Fusk is embezzling the canteen fund in Centravian, while the Southern Hemisphere read, and Mrs. Fusk is a convicted shoplifter and their horribly ugly son, Mark, is a known snitch. Naturally, the League of Planets ordered that this Earth place be atomized right away because of this totally mind-boggling geographic insult to one of its members. This was great because it wiped out all the evidence of our messing around, like all the beer cans we dumped in the Jurassic period.
Yeah, so it's a good conclusion. So it's like a kind of a smart sci-fi story mixed in with the totally juvenile humor strip too.
Yeah, And Alan Moore and all the other writers who were working for 2000 AD were cranking these out every week. Like, most issues of 2000 AD had one, like, little standalone story like that. And it's 6 pages long. It gets in and it gets out, and that's it.
Yeah.
There's a story that Moore did with Dave Gibbons a little bit after this called Chronocops that I've actually assigned in some of my classes at PSU. Mm-hmm. I assign students to retro-engineer a script for it because it packs so much story into 5 pages that, like, you have to call your shots really carefully about, like, what are you going to tell an artist they need to represent? What are you going to leave to them?
Mm-hmm.
And what are the important things here? What are the things that somebody has to draw to make this story work?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is also 100% a Dave Gibbons showcase. It is giving Dave Gibbons a chance to do his impression of Will Elder's Dragnet parodies in Mad.
Mm. Nice.
And it's also like a time travel and time paradox story, and it's also a comedy.
Cool. And it's 6 pages?
5.
5 pages. Yeah, yeah. I always do the 4-page comic is always in the goal of like every workshop I've ever done. And it's like, you got to learn how to do it in 4 pages. You know, you got the single pages, the double page spread, you got to establish everything on one, you know, like you gotta, and I always say, you know, people always go, oh, I want to write this, you know, 300 issue opus. You go, you can't write that until you write the 4-page story.
Yeah. And everybody who was writing for 2080, like all the stories are 4 pages, 5 pages, 6 pages long. Like, you have to make each one a satisfying chunk in no space at all.
Yep.
And make it end with something that's going to make you want to read the next part.
Yeah, and get, like, context in there really organically within the story movie. Yeah, it's great. It's a great challenge. I mean, there's not really anything like this in the U.S., right? We've never anthologies going.
You know, the one time there was a weekly anthology that did anything in America. It was, I guess, in the late 80s, DC did Action Comics Weekly, which had like 6 or 8 different serials going at once. And as I understand, the reason it failed was not that it was not selling well, but that the FedEx costs associated with getting everything where it had to be were making it not profitable.
It was pre-scanners.
Pre-scanners, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if you could... I mean, I feel like now, like, DC is always, like, throwing a bonus story, but it's always crap, you know? Like, I would love to see a really curated... I know it's hard, though. Like, there's been even, like, Moam that Fantagraphics does is really good. Or when I was in college, those Meat House anthologies were really impactful on me. But I don't know. It's always, like, such a range of stuff, too. Like, it's hard to get a really curated anthology. And then the grind of this, too. And then just, like, probably market issues, you know? Like, because this probably sells on newsstands and it sells crazy copies, right? And everybody pulps it.
So at the time when this was being published, 2000 AD was, as Garth Ennis put it, printed on bog roll. Like, it was the cheapest newsprint.
Yeah.
Mostly black and white. There's like 4 pages of color per issue. By a few years after this, it went full color. It is now on somewhat fancier paper, and there's not really so much newsstand distribution of it anymore, but it does well enough through British comic stores and through subscriptions that, like, it's still going after 2,300 issues.
Is it still doing well?
Yeah, and cool. It's still really good, is the thing.
Yeah, oh, that's like, cool.
There's a serial called Brink that Dan Abnett and I and Jay Culbert have been doing for the last couple of years. Mm. It's fantastic. Like, I've given the first volume to a bunch of friends, and they're like, where can I get the rest of this?
Yeah.
It is a sort of Lovecraftian police procedural in outer space. Mm-hmm. And it's really stylish and really smart, and yeah, it's really fun.
Why do you think that so many of the best, like, high concept kind of sci-fi mainstream comics writers have come out of 2008? Why are they all from the UK?
Because like I said, they had to learn how to tell stories in a really compact way. And you know, there's also like this wave of artists and writers who were really, really great. I'm going to digress again. There's an amazing podcast that Andrew Hickey does called The History of Rock and Roll in 500 Songs. And he is a British comics and music historian, and he tends, like, when he talks about the subject, he goes back and back and back and back and back to historical roots. Like, he did an episode on Sympathy for the Devil that was 7.5 hours long and starts with like 45 minutes on the trial of Oscar Wilde, which eventually ties in. But he says you cannot understand anything about British popular culture without understanding the end of the British Empire and how between 1945 and 1970 or so, it went from being the biggest empire in the history of the world to a tiny, tiny little island nation fighting for respect. And so much of British, like, his lens is that so much of British popular culture, including 2000 AD, is people who thought they really had to be impressive. There is that drive to just, like, do something so awesome that nobody will believe it, that you see showing up in these comics, and you also see it showing up in some ways in British pop music and the way that British pop music treats itself, like treating itself like the most important thing in the world. There were British Comics Awards, like the Eagle Awards were a thing at a time when there weren't really American Comics Awards, but the Eagle Awards were doing their thing because they needed to wave the flag for themselves, and they ended up waving the flag for some American comics too. And then we get the Eisners and the Harveys and everything else. So that's one way of thinking about it. I think also like having to work on a weekly deadline, which is a tighter deadline than any American comics have had to work on, and do things in satisfying tiny chunks. Like you don't, there's no room to coast. There's no time to coast. You just have to freaking get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And that you get your John Wagners and your Pat Mills and all these other people who come out of that, like, here's the pressure cooker, 5 pages, we need it now. It seems like that has something to do with it, but, you know, this is Whig history. This is explaining after the fact why it had to be that way.
It's just interesting, like, the whole Vertigo line is always all these British writers. It's always been interesting. Well, back on, so January 84, DR and Quinch come back. They're on the cover.
Yeah.
They're in color. Quinch is purple. Didn't know. Yep. And so the second story, they're tried for their crimes, right?
There's this amazing trial scene at the beginning where, you know, you get the judge who has like long bony fingers and this huge pointed beak coming down. And there's this wonderful sight gag on the first page where the judge is listing off their crimes, you know, transmuting base metal into gold, genocide, spitting, like everything. While somebody who is sitting next to Quinch is watching him peel a Band-Aid off of his chin and eat it.
Oh, yeah, that's subtle.
And then falls over, just like faint. And you turn the page and you see the courtroom is just jammed with people like holding up nooses and signs crying out for their blood. While, you know, DR is going into his speech about, like, we're fantastically incredibly sorry for all these extremely unreasonable things that we did. Your Honor, we sincerely want to grow up and change our irresponsible ways, and I'm not just saying that. And this is also where we get Quinch's one line of dialogue that he ever says out loud, which is, it's right.
Oh, is that right? Everything else is exposition?
Yeah.
Or is, captions?
Yeah, we see him narrating, but I think just about the only thing he ever says out loud, it's right.
No, I didn't catch that. Yeah, that's a good,
No, actually, he also, well, he recognizes someone at the end of Get Drafted. But that's about it.
There we go. There's two then. Yeah. So they get a sentencing, but then they're going to basically have to do community service before their sentencing. And so this is pretty good. So they buy the house next to the judge's house, and they make it. It's not the first kind of Vietnam vet reference, actually. There's quite a bit of Vietnam vet references throughout this run. But they're created like a rehab clinic next to his house, right?
Yes. A charity for the rehabilitation of dangerous maniac ex-servicemen in need of love and understanding. We will also need a monstrously huge government loan in order to fund this utterly heart-wringing venture.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And then basically the space equivalent of the Viet Cong come, right? And there's going to be a conflict between them next door to the judge's house. And that's the cliffhanger.
Yeah.
So I wonder what happens next.
Everything goes straight to hell. Right. There's references to the, quote, recently ended Goyogi slime jungle wars.
Yeah, that keeps coming up. That comes up also throughout the whole thing.
Sure does. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what comes to the neighborhood is the Goyogi peace delegation, who have come to make peace. And of course, there is now this halfway house full of, you know, hyper-violent veterans of this particular war who are now armed to the teeth and massacre the entire peace delegation. And, I mean, you know, it's basically the same ending as the previous story.
Well, so the judge, it's like an elaborate, the judge is credited with, well, the mayor comes to see the charity, and he likes what they're doing. And the judge is credited. So you think for a minute, they're like, oh, they're going to get the judge to like them and leave their sentence. But then the I just wrote them down as Vietnamese stereotype aliens. they arrive. There's a big conflict and a war, and then the judge is blamed for the conflict.
Yep. And the Goyogi War is back on now. Yeah. And their neighbor says, me and the guys have enlisted for an 8-year tour of duty. Listen, I can't thank you kids enough.
Right. Yeah. Sam was there.
And again, like, this is Ellen Davis showing off all the way. Like, at the beginning of the story, there's a bit, the first time you see Pulger, who's their, like, vet friend, you see him sort of sneaking around a corner to attack a teddy bear. And when you turn the page, you see that the teddy bear has three eyes and antennae.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, there's no reason that has to be there. It's just there because it's funny.
It's nice details.
Yeah.
And then we get a three-parter.
Yes.
And so they do the first appearance, and then there's a gap, and then it's every week after that, right?
It's every week for a few weeks. I think there's a break before. I guess Get Drafted is right after that, and then Hollywood is, yeah, there's a little bit of a break before Hollywood, but like 4 weeks.
Okay. Probably just to get it done, right? You know, a little lead time maybe sometimes. So then the second one, and it's three parts.
Three, I think.
Yeah, DR and Quinch go girl crazy, and it's pretty good. DR tells her, DR stands for deeply religious. I liked that joke a lot. So he meets a nice girl, and he's trying to, you know, he's wearing sweaters and trying to pretend he's someone he's not.
I should also say that DR, as something in the legal system, apparently means diminished responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Like someone who is not responsible for their actions.
Oh, and that's what DR stands for in this. Yeah. So that's what that's a reference to. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it. I didn't get that. I don't know enough about our legal system, unfortunately. Yeah. And her name is Chrysoprasia. Does that mean something?
I don't think so. It's just sort of an angelic sounding name.
Okay.
Because she is, as she describes herself, a goody two flippers.
Okay.
Like, she's yet another alien design. Every single character who turns up in the series is a new alien design by Ellen Davis.
Yeah, there's some really great. Actually, Quinch's design is really cool. Like the patterning on him and the way he does it in foreshortening and things. Yeah, it's really. I mean, yeah, the design of everything is pretty incredible. And the lighting. So, but that's essentially what's going on is DR is kind of becoming a square, right? Yep. Or he's trying to be, and then.
Because he's met a girl, and he wants to impress her, and she is the daughter of the new drama coach at their school.
That's right.
And so he's, you know, trying to be an actor so he can be close to her.
And then, so in the second part, Quinch kidnaps her to show her what DR is really like.
Yeah.
So he shows it's a little Clockwork Orangey, but not so much, not overtly like. And then her response is to become more delinquent herself.
Yeah, and she snaps. She's like, no more cleaning my teeth and freestyle square dancing. From now on, I'm going to be the kind of woman that my Waldo deserves. It's goodbye, Chrysoprasia, and hello, Crazy Chrissy. Give me that beer, pig breath.
So, yeah, and then then DR has a performance, and she crashes it.
Yep.
And then he sells her out, right?
Yeah.
As she gets in trouble for crashing the performance, and that thus ends their relationship, right?
Ish. Well, for the time being.
Yeah, right. We may not have seen the last of her. And there's a gag in here where there's something about food, and he says, unless I had been driven temporarily insane by secret trace chemicals hidden within that vegan takeaway meal that I ate a month ago. But is that pre-veganism being a term? Like, that's vegan,
it was definitely a thing. There is a joke in a Bo Jeffrey saga episode that Moore wrote about this time where the vegan vampire has gone to the store for soy blood.
Mm.
Because
I know, like, in Marvel comics, I always liked that the Vegans were, like, a race. And so I never knew if that was, like, sort of a generic alien name term or...
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, so that scene is an excuse for, like, Quinch to bond with DR again. Like, it's a real male bonding moment there.
Mm-hmm. They get back together. Yeah. And then, we lead into, is this where they get drafted?
Yeah. DR and Quinch get drafted.
Goes on for a while, right? We got one.
That's two, a five-parter.
Three, four, five of them. Yeah,
I mean, for a while means 5 weeks.
5 weeks, yeah. But yeah, like, just as I was reading this, I was like, oh, okay, there's more serials. That, I mean, I didn't know what to expect. So yeah. They get drafted.
And, of course, they're drafted to the war that they have restarted. The war on Goyogi, yeah. So there's, like, some basic training jokes. The first part is, like, it's 5 pages long, but it's a parody of, like, every, like, basic training, like getting the troops, toughening up the troops by torturing them scene you've ever seen.
And there's a traditional Alan Moore character singing. He's one of those. I'm always of a mind that music and singing doesn't work in comics. And Alan Moore is like a master of comics, but he doesn't care. He's like, I'm going to put a song in the middle of this.
He also puts poems in there, mm-hmm. as you see, because there's the British tradition of war poetry. There's all their great World War I poets. And so we see a couple episodes later, DR is now locked up in the stockade and writing his, quote, incredibly sensitive war poem, which goes, "We could be sat in sun-kit fields and watch the buffalunks grazing. Instead, we're locked up on Goyogi," which is, like, totally amazing.
I was moved by that personally. Yeah. So then they're on the planet, right? Yeah. And then we got a recurring character.
Pulger comes Pulger.
Back. Yeah, Pulger yeah. comes back. And that's actually the the finale of the second issue.
Yeah.
So they were reconvened with him. And then there's a lot of jokes that didn't age well as of the last 10 years. Yeah, where Pulger's wearing a dress and it's a allusion to him being crazy. It's part of his escape plan, though, right?
Right. Where he has carved a piece of soap into the shape of a machine gun so they can use it to intimidate anyone who tries to stop them, and has also carved half a pound of plastic explosive into the form of a bar of soap. It's a really ornate escape plan involving forcing the guards into an escape tunnel.
That's right. So this I thought was very funny because it's like he basically has all the elements of a perfect escape plan, but the order is like he's doing the wrong thing with all the pieces. So you want to break it down?
Oh, he says, "We blow up the cells of diversion using the explosive soap. When the guards investigate, they'll think I'm just some woman and fall in love with me. Suddenly, I whip out the soap gun and force them into the escape tunnel, replacing the slab so they can't get out. Then we refuse to tell anybody where the guards have gone until they promise to let us go."
Right, yeah.
You're so close.
It's really good. So yeah. So that I like. You could also say that him wearing a dress to escape is a reference to Stalin did that.
Yeah. Or, you know, Klinger on MASH.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Would this be? Yeah, because this would. Yeah, which didn't work for Klinger though.
Yeah. So they take the escape tunnel. They run into a monster that eats half of the soap gun, and you can see like soap bubbles coming out of its mouth.
Yeah.
And you know, get out of the escape tunnel, and at the other end of the escape tunnel is Chrysoprasia.
Yep, she's down there. So reunited, things are really coming full circle.
Dior's jilted girlfriend.
Here. Yeah. But yeah, that escape plan, that to me was maybe the funniest bit in the whole thing. Just like the elaborate pieces and how they were all in the wrong. Yeah, that was good. I just wrote more of the same for part four. Yes.
There really is. And it is an act four. It is escalating. It is, here's the situation. Let's get it louder and louder and louder.
Yeah, there's conflict within the characters, and then the two armies convene with our protagonists kind of stuck in between them, and that's the cliffhanger.
And it is resolved in the final part by an enormous, horrible space monster landing and crushing all the troops into a pulp.
That's right.
Eventually, the enormous space monster says, "Ernest," and Quinch says, "Oh, hi, Mom."
Oh, so there he goes. He says, "Hi, Mom," also. There we go. Okay.
That's the person. Yeah. And, you know, Quinch's mother comes and rescues them.
That's the end. It ends with a "your mom" joke. Yeah.
Yes.
And I can say I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
It was not a predictable ending. It was sort of I didn't think he had a gigantic mother. I had no idea. So And then we get into so then they go Hollywood. There's a prologue, and then that's the rest of the run, is this Hollywood extravaganza.
And that's my favorite one, the whole bunch, the Hollywood one.
Tell me about it.
This is the one where they finally get put in a situation that is even more chaotic than they are,
mm-hmm.
and just outdo the chaos. They land in a bus depot. There's an old man who comes up to them. He's this worn down old ruin of a guy who explains that he used to be a famous screenwriter, and then he got writer's block and lost everything. And his boss said, like, okay, you're washed up now. Here's 2 tickets to Hollywood in case you ever come up with something good again. But he's finally got it. He's got a script. It's going to be a blockbuster. And suddenly he drops dead.
Mm-hmm.
And DR and Quinch are like, okay. And they, you know, rummage through his pockets and get his tickets, and they grab a script and they go off to seek their fortune in Hollywood, which they explain, quote, by a stupendous galactic coincidence, there was also Hollywood on Earth, which was like this completely worthless scumball planet that me and Quinch destroyed one time. This isn't that Hollywood. This is different Hollywood.
Yeah. Space Hollywood.
Space have Hollywood. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. As a writer, have you had any Hollywood dealings?
I have not.
No.
More's the pity.
I know. I see that you're upset about it. I thought maybe you would be relieved, but...
Yeah, well, you know, if we think of this as anticipating Alan Moore's future problems with Hollywood.
Yeah, it's kind of preemptive, I thought, yeah, because it seems like something that would have come later, because, although, you know, that League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie.
But we see them immediately, you know, mug the first couple of important looking people they find. And so, you know, suddenly they're wearing a waistband and a cummerbund, and DR has a beret and a cane and a monocle, and they are looking full like Hollywood royalty. Stroll into like the biggest restaurant in town and announce, you know, DR's first line when he goes into the restaurant is, I want 15 Emperor lobsters, man, and I want them all wearing little knitted waistcoats in Prussian blue. This of course attracts attention, and within 2 pages, they have, you know, got themselves a massive Hollywood deal just from being so, you know, having such broad personalities.
Yeah, they fake it till they make it, right? Yeah.
DR has a hissy fit because, quote, you never serve any food wearing Prussian blue accessories without a side order of chocolate-coated ant's brains. That's simple etiquette, man.
And then there's a Marlon Brando. Oh, it's not even a Marlon Brando parody. It's just supposed to be Marlon. I mean, I guess it's Space Marlon Brando. Brando.
It is Space Marlon Brando, yes. It is Space Marlon Brando or Space Burt, presumably Space Burt Reynolds, who are the big two. Like, they have to get one of these actors. And
we don't see Burt Reynolds, though, do we?
No, we don't. We just see him mentioned.
Yeah, he's mentioned, and then Marlon Brando jumps on the project.
Right.
Because he's hearing that Burt Reynolds is going to get it. And he's written really kind of phonetically, very stylized dialect, which I thought was pretty good.
It is all mumbling. And the cliffhanger for that episode is one of their new associates says, oh, yeah, the script. Oh, you got it from Turketo Jubbly. You know, funny thing about old TJ, like, nobody could ever read his handwriting. It was completely illegible to anybody except him. So what's this script of yours called? And DR looks at the script and goes, well, I can't exactly reveal that to you right now, man, but the third word is probably oranges.
something oranges.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that's their whole thing. But then they're working on it though. They got a production deal. So they're making the movie without really being able to read the script. And then Marlon Brando reads it. He loves it. And he delivers a whole scene of unintelligible words. Yes. And no one can understand him. So.
And again, like, this is Alan Davis completely showing off. Like, this is Alan Davis drawing Space Marlon Brando chewing the scenery for a page.
Mm-hmm.
With dramatic lighting, with the body language, like, just nailing the caricature.
Yeah, it's a nice one. It's definitely nicely done. And I mean, wouldn't you say, I mean, I don't know, because again, I don't know the rich history of 2000 AD, but would you say these are very like Mad, early Mad inspired, like Harvey Kurtzman inspired?
I mean, there are definitely some people there who liked that stuff. Alan Moore was definitely one of them. Like, the like Chronocops being straight up a Will Elder homage, like really Mad homage. But also, like, there is something of British comedy about this, like Bagoon Show and Monty Python and that general strain of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Douglas Adams.
Douglas Adams, yeah.
Yeah, you can kind of draw a line there.
Yeah, so they're ordering all this weird stuff, including 16,000 oranges for their production.
Because they have no idea what's in the script, so they're just ordering like the most spectacular things they can find. We see them at the beginning of shooting. DR is decked out in his director outfit going, lights, lights, cameras, cameras, heavy artillery, women dressed as giant crabs, women dressed as
I love those women dressed as giant crabs. I don't know why. That really was working for me.
Incredibly strange, awful, insane creatures with blowtorches. Incredibly strange. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So then they have this huge pile of oranges, mumbling Marlon Brando. He's reaching for one. Mind the oranges, Marlon, someone shouts to him, and he's crushed by a huge pile of oranges.
Yes. And now what are they going to do? Their leading man is dead. Well, we find out in the next part that they have, they knew the third word of the title was oranges, and it had four words in it, so it's now called Mind the Oranges, Marlon.
And it's like a documentary tribute to him, right?
Well, it's just whatever Quinch happened to shoot, because they just gave him a camera and he wandered around all the, you know, the women dressed as giant crabs and incredibly horrible creatures and Marlon Brando getting crushed by 16,000 oranges.
Right. So we get sort of like an after it comes out, like they're being interviewed. And are these caricatures of real people? I don't recognize. They look they must be.
They look like they have to be. I don't know who they are. I'm sure they're like British TV personalities, and I don't know who they are.
Barry Normal and some reviewer, Film Week reviewer.
Yeah.
But so the movie comes out. It doesn't really. It's not really clear how the D'Aaron Quinch's lives are affected by having made this movie, though, right?
Their lives are being threatened by the studio president, although the movie has become a cult classic. And also, Waldo Dobbs, fiend or folk hero, genius or juvenile delinquent, two things are certain. One, nobody knows where he is. Two, the same goes for the box office takings. And we see him having escaped with all the money. And
Quinch
going back to the bus depot where TJ comes back to life and says he's about to head to Hollywood with the script, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, that's showbiz, man. That's the last line.
Yeah.
So we left that out too. They say man a lot, right? As part of their
very
delinquent
much so.
Teenager appeal. So thus concludes DR and Quinch forever.
So what is your assessment of this thing?
I liked it. I mean, I think the ongoing kind of question of this is, did you have to be 12 when you read it? So many of the runs, and I always ask people, what kind of was formative for you? So even myself, like some of the most formative comics I read that made me like a comics lifer, if you read them now, like the part of me that's 12 remembers it, but I mean, there's stuff that holds up too, Watchmen holds up, Dark Knight Returns holds up. Anything that involves David Mazzucchelli holds up. But these were fun. I mean, for me, it was like a nice kind of a deep Alan Moore deep cut. It was a treat. I would say overall, I probably enjoy heavier Alan Moore. Although I said like top 10 was my favorite of the that kind of was a good balance of them. It was like a humor, but also a police procedural drama, So I really liked the funny stuff in that is really funny. Sometimes Alan Moore is not funny, I would say, when he's working on being funny. But no, I mean, to me, this was just a nice, and like I said, you invite Douglas Wolk on your podcast. This is kind of what you hope comes out of it. Cause I had never even heard of this and it's hard to get too, right?
Yeah, I think that there's a reprint published a couple of years ago that the one that I'm holding is like it was published in the U.S. It's got the U.S. $18 cover price on it. There's also a color edition of it that came out. It doesn't look as good in color. It really, really does not. The other thing I think is really interesting about it was the context of the comic that it was in. Because the other stuff that was running in 2008 at the same time, I don't know if you paged through those issues at all, but like there's Slain, which is Pat Mills and Mick McMahon doing this wild kind of sword and sorcery thing with this kind of almost woodcut scratchboard looking visual technique to it. There's Rogue Trooper, which is exactly the kind of war story that De'Aaron Quinch get drafted as parodying. And there's Judge Dredd, and there's a Strontium Dog, which is the other, which is the John Wagner and Carlos Ascara strip that is not Judge Dredd, that both Wagner and Ascara apparently like doing better than they like doing Judge Dredd. And you mentioned, like, you know, going back to stuff that you read when you were a teenager. So I read 2080 for a long time. I finally stopped reading it in the 90s when I couldn't get copies anymore and when it was sort of going into a slump. And then around, I guess, in the mid-2000s, they started reprinting of the earliest Dredd stories in these big anthologies, and I thought, well, I'm going to pick this up and see how it's aged. Will I like it as much as I did then? And I found, oh, I like it better now than I did then. Like, it got better. I was not expecting that to happen, but okay.
That's cool.
Because there's a point where Dredd stops being this fantasy about, like, political violence with no consequences and turns into a story about the consequences of political violence, which it has been ever since. And the last 30 odd years of the strip have been about the pigeons coming home to roost.
That's cool.
And all the kind of knock on consequences of, like, the wild violence of the first 10 years.
And Judge Dredd's been done by a lot of different people, right?
It has, but also John Wagner, who is the original writer, like, is still writing about 20% of the time.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. After 45 years. Wow. Also all the characters age in real time.
So all the characters are
Yeah, they're all 45 years older now than they were when it started.
That's cool. Yeah, I mean, that's, again, one of my biggest blind spots in all of comics is Judge. I think I've never read a Judge Dredd comic, but that's cool. I mean, it's great coming back to stuff, too, or noticing. I mean, I think, again, that's why one of the reasons Watchmen's so enduring, because it really rewards multiple reads, you know. But yeah, some of the stuff holds up better. But so you're feeling that way too. Like you like coming back to this, and it holds up for you.
Yeah, De'Aaron Quinch, like it's pretty steady. Like it doesn't. It maybe, like, as you said, some of the jokes haven't aged terribly well. Some of them have. Like it's funny. It's Alan Moore being super clever. You know, whenever he does. Even like one of the poem or song interludes, they rhyme and scan correctly.
Yeah.
Like they work, like they click. And it's Alan Davis absolutely hitting it out of the park in every page. Like it is funny, funny cartooning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nice lighting and nice character design. And yeah.
And there's not too much of it. There's those five stories and that's all we need.
Yeah, I know. I remember when you sent me this, you were like, I know it's a lot of, it's 16 installments, but they're all really short. So it's not that much. You're like, okay, because, it was quick. It was a quick read and it was fun to read through. So, yeah, no, I would say thank you for bringing this on. This is definitely not something I was expecting. I mean, that's one of my, I do this podcast for a lot of reasons. I just like having these conversations. And then often it's an excuse to read something I've been meaning to read for a long time. And then in this case, it's like, it's fun too when someone brings up a run and I don't even know anything about it. And, you know, with mixed results sometimes, but this was a positive outcome.
I'll say actually one other interesting 2008 thing. The other kind of major Alan Moore serial for it was The Ballad of Halo Jones, which was, there were kind of three long serials published. There were supposed to be 10, And then Moore had a falling out with IPC, the publisher then. Mm-hmm. And it never got continued. A couple of years ago, Dan Abnett and Mark Harrison started doing a thing in 2018 called The Out, which it is not Halo Jones. It is not the continuation of Halo Jones, but it has a very similar premise to Halo Jones. And it's okay. It is not, we're going to continue this abandoned story. It's, we're going to take this premise and do it as we would do it now. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really cool.
That's cool. Yeah. We'll do that next. And then we'll do Big Numbers. It's just as soon as it's done, you know, so we'll wait till they finish it.
Okay. But, one of my happiest possessions, ooh, I own a copy of Alan Moore's script for the third issue of Big Numbers.
Whoa, cool.
Which
how
never
did
came
you
out.
Get that? Yeah.
It was auctioned through the CBLDF about 20 years ago.
Wow, that is cool. I actually never read the first two issues because I knew it didn't end, but I've looked through it.
They're real good. Yeah. It is a wonderful comic, and it would be nice if it would have been finished, but there's the two, and actually somebody like at some point the artwork for part three of the unlettered artwork surfaced somewhere, mm-hmm, and somebody else had a copy of the script and they kind of pieced it together and made a lettered version of it that you can find online.
Oh, that's cool. I've read, that's one of those, I mean, for 30 years, I've heard different accounts of what happened to the third issue. And, you know, I've heard all these different stories, but yeah, anyway, I was just joking around because I know they never finished that, but, cool. Well, I think we're starting to wrap up. There's a few. The other thing I wanted to say to you as I had you on here is the thing that blew my mind in that James Brown book was when James Brown says it's getting a little cold outside. He's referring to the Cuban Missile Crisis. That is one of my most repeated facts I've learned of my whole life. I was like, oh my God, when I read that. And then that's not a thing anymore, the 33 and a third books, right?
No, they're still going.
Would you just did that one, right?
I just did that one, yeah.
Would you do another one? What would you do if you didn't?
They don't pay so great. No, there are other people who want to do them more. I think the first record I proposed to do a 33 and a third about was there's a compilation that Rough Trade US put out in 1980 called Wanna Buy a Bridge.
Okay.
And the editor was like, could you perhaps do a record that anybody has ever heard of?
Yeah, I was like, okay, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, so, okay, let's Live at the Apollo.
So but if you were going to do one that would be accepted by editorial, what do you think you would do?
Oh, geez. That is not a thought I've had. That is really not. There is a book that I might want to write that is not about an album, but is about a single song. Mm. And I'm not going to give away what that is. But because I might do it at some point.
Oh, keep us watching. Well, so if I'm going to follow you online, like I don't already, where do I find you, Douglas Wolk?
DouglasWolk.com is a good one. Or just put my name after Blue Sky or Facebook or basically any social media thing. I just use my name, Douglas Wolk.
You just use your name. That's cool. Yeah. I'll find you. I have Blue Sky. I got to start using it. I think I'm not a social media guy. So, but apparently seems like the right moment to start doing that one. Like it hasn't soured yet.
It's not a requirement for a happy life.
It's not a requirement for a happy life, but it helps if you got your new project coming out and you go, I've avoided social media my whole life. Maybe this was the moment have you ever thought about writing comics, being a comics writer?
I have in fact written comics. The one significant comic I've ever gotten to do, I wrote a Judge Dredd miniseries about 10 years ago that Ulysses Farinas drew.
Oh, crazy!
Called Mega City 2, or City of Quartz.
Oh.
It is mostly about how much I hate L.A.
Okay, that's sold. Yeah. Okay, but then, so I ask everyone at the end, what would your dream run be? And that could either be something you wrote with an artist, or just assigning an artist-writer and a writer to a series.
Okay, so if I'm thinking about work for hire comics and work for hire properties and people who have written and drawn work for hire properties, mm-hmm, I'm going to say, like, as much as I am really enjoying the current Fantastic Four run, like, It's Red North. It's a lot of fun. Al Ewing writing Fantastic Four would be amazing.
Okay.
He has such a feeling for those characters every time he gets to write them. And artist-wise, Marcos Martin.
Yeah, he's fantastic. So good. He's so, and on Fantastic Four too, makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And yeah, he's drawn that's a little bit of those characters and they look great. An Al Ewing, Marcos Martin Fantastic Four book, like, I would buy 5 copies of each of those.
Yeah, I would pick that up. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I'm such an old grouch about mainstream comics now. And I always say I want one run. I don't want it to tie into anything. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read hardly any Marvel comics for a long time over that. But the one, I didn't collect it. I read it after the fact. Mm-hmm. But the one of the runs I read all the way through was Immortal Hulk.
Right?
That was a phenomenal run. Yeah, although I got to read it again to figure out what happened at the end. There were a lot of things I didn't get as it went, but that would be a cool run to do over like 5 episodes of this, because it's about 50 issues, I think, right?
Yeah, and even like the extra crossover bits, like there's an Absolute Carnage one-shot that's a Immortal Hulk thing, is amazing.
Oh, okay. Like I didn't remember it ever breaking out of the main thing, which is so important to me.
Yeah, all the breakouts are titles outside of Immortal Hulk proper. But, like, there's an Immortal Hulk, there's the Absolute Carnage one, there's a King in Black one, and I think there's, like, Wonder... Oh, right, there's the Best Defense, like the Defenders thing.
Mm. Cool, but that's a good pick. Al Ewing and Marcus Martin. I also really love... I think before that, the run I did buy was... when Mark Waid was coming on Daredevil and it was Marcos Martin and Paulo Rivera alternating, I was like, that's it. And then they left and Chris Somni came on and I bought that whole thing.
Just when you think it can't get better, Chris Somni shows up. Yeah.
Chris Somni. Because I would, like any run, I would put Chris. I'm waiting for Chris Somni to do Spider-Man.
That would be great.
I would pick that up.
I'm really curious what he is going to do now that Firepower's over and... I mean, is he just going to do John and the Impossible Monsters? Maybe?
He's doing right now. These come out way later.
That's right.
He's doing
Batman and Robin. Yeah.
Okay. Batman and Robin year one. So that's actually, I have trouble picking up floppies anymore for these old aging guy reasons I said, but that I'm always looking for stuff. And actually, so that's one I'm picking up. And then one thing I have in my hold box when it comes out is Al Ewing and Metamorpho.
It just came out this Wednesday. Okay. It's Steve Lieber drawing it.
Steve Lieber.
Great. Yes. Yeah. Okay. It is so much fun.
Yeah, that's in my hold box. I thought it wasn't coming out till February for some reason. I don't pay close attention to this stuff.
And actually, just to tie everything together, my favorite ongoing serial comic right now is the Power Fantasy, the thing that Kieran Gillen is doing with, what's his name? His name will come, artist name will come to me. But the part of the pitch for that is like, okay, what was the record that was like the big hit during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Mm-hmm. It's like,
that's a thing I know something about. and in fact, like the record that I believe was number one in England then was Telstar. And so there's a little subplot early on about like listening to Telstar during the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Hmm. That's cool. Well, that's a nice, I think that wraps it up. So thanks so much for doing the show, sharing your expertise. Everyone should read all of the Marvels if they haven't already.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
Yeah. Anything else you want to plug before we get out of here?
Nothing to plug. Just buy everything you can find by this guy, Ryan Alexander Tanner. Oh. I hear he's great.
Oh, gosh. All right. And that's a wrap. All right. That was the Douglas Wolk episode of The Runs. I hope you enjoyed it. That guy's like, if Wikipedia was a man, it would be Douglas Wolk. It's cool to get to talk to him. I like those deep cuts. I learned a lot about Alan Moore and life. I gotta say too, he sent me that James Brown book I asked for, the 33 and a third book. That was super cool of him. What a nice fellow. Thanks very much to him. Make sure you check out his All the Marvels book. In his writing in general, he's done many great things that you should check out.
And thanks for listening to Runs. Make sure you rate and review us, subscribe, yada, yada, yada. You can find me at oyesverynice.com and oyesverynice on various social media platforms. We got a lot more cool stuff coming your way. Tune in next week to another exciting episode of The Runs.